How Michael Stays Young. Michael springs up onto the oak refectory table in his dining room, bending his head so his curls just brush the ceiling. He wears faded jeans and a white collarless shirt and announces to his party guests, when they've finished singing Happy Birthday, that he's the luckiest man alive. "It's this family of mine," he grins at everyone. The children are upstairs asleep, but his pale, plump wife, Julia, is sitting at the side of the room, dressed in black, looking out of the window at the night. "I may be 50 chronologically," he says, "but they keep me, well, forever young." He laughs with joy. He is triumphant. Michael's house, its rooms painted the colours of a glowing Mediterranean twilight, is filled with tureens of Moroccan tagine and gliding, bright-eyed somebodies. Each of his acquaintances assumes that all the others there are close friends. Carolyn, from the house opposite, stands among this crowd of strangers. She can't remember the last time she went to a party. She hates making small talk. She hates the way people flicker their gaze around the room, over her shoulder, and grab the earliest chance to escape. And her husband can't resist a free drink. That's when the real trouble starts. Carolyn thinks tonight that Michael is the most beautiful man she's ever seen. She felt like that about her husband once. But now she yearns to get close enough to look right into Michael's eyes. She noticed earlier, when he let them in, a big crowd arriving all together, that his eyes are hazel, like hers. She's sure somehow that they'd both see something. Something that they'd recognise. At the end of the summer, Michael stands in the front porch in bare feet and waves until his children disappear, their small faces looking at him through the back window of Julia's Renault. There's been a removal van outside the house all morning, big enough for half of absolutely everything, and the rabbits in their hutch. Julia, slim now and dressed in russet tones that match her hair, is taking the children to live in a rented house in Ladbroke Grove, around the corner from her new boyfriend. Carolyn can't remember how she knows this. She saw Julia gesture in Michael's direction with her thermos before she got into the car, which must have been to make things easier for the children. But his face stayed white and set, as though she wasn't there. Carolyn doesn't see Michael again for the whole of that weekend. Not in his bedroom up on the top floor. Not even a quick movement reflected in the corner of the mirror along its back wall. Not in the ensuite bathroom behind its green wood blinds. Not in the basement den with beanbag cushions covered in giraffes, where the children used to loll on a Saturday morning while Michael washed his car. She knows he must be in one of the rooms at the back of the house that she can't see, but she worries about him, imagining him unshaven in his dressing gown all weekend. She worries about what the children might find when they come back. She heard, once, about a man with money worries who'd hanged himself, with his son's belt, in his son's room, on his son's birthday. "She's left him," Carolyn shouts through to her husband. She goes into the lounge and picks up three empty beer cans next to him on the floor. "She's taken the children," she says. She's blocking his view of the football, and he moves his eyes and focuses on her with the hurt, dull look of a man unjustly woken from a deep sleep. "Who has?" he asks. Carolyn sees Michael at the school gates every Wednesday and Thursday when it's his turn to have the children. He wears a beige raincoat that reminds her of the one her father had when she was little, with pockets that he'd fill with sweets for her to jump up and find, like an excited puppy when he came back from his weekly selling trips away. She quickly settles into the rhythm of it. Wednesdays and Thursdays she washes her hair and puts concealer on the shadows under her eyes. She wears ankle boots with a slight heel under her jeans instead of trainers. She buys a new silk-lined jacket, dove grey corduroy, with slightly puffed shoulders. Oddly, since they live so close to one another, since she was even invited to his birthday party, they never speak. They keep their distance. She's not even sure by now if he knows who she is. Julia, on the other hand, seems to seek Carolyn out when she's there at the school on the other days. Julia was standoffish when she lived across the road, frowning as she hauled up weeds in the front garden, not so much as looking up if someone walked right past. Julia used to keep herself to herself. But this Julia, wearing peachy blusher, with a smile in her eyes, engages everyone. This Julia is irresistible. She gleams like a glossy piece of burnished copper. "I had to get away," she tells Carolyn, as though they're old friends. And it doesn't seem altogether out of place, such intimacy. Carolyn has, after all, seen this woman dressed in nothing but a towel, gathering dirty laundry from the floor. She's seen her cross-legged on her bed, picking dirt from under her fingernails. She's seen her in her shapeless tracksuit, motionless in the rocking chair next to the piano, staring for hours into space. In the spring, Michael exchanges his raincoat for a brown suede bomber jacket. He's drawn into the group of mothers, into the talk of school trips and fickle children's friendships. And when Carolyn's daughter comes running out to her one afternoon, holding her new friend's hand, begging that she be allowed to come back and play, Carolyn turns to him almost without thinking. "My daughter," she smiles, shaking her head. She's left it too late to teach her child the importance of taking no for an answer, and secretly it makes her proud. "A force to be reckoned with," she laughs. "That's for sure." "Like her mother," says Michael. And they stand there for a few seconds, smiles a little frozen, his words in the air between them, as if they're both wondering what he could possibly have meant. Carolyn keeps this tiny exchange with her everywhere she goes, getting it out from time to time like polishing a precious jewel. And somewhere along the line, it takes on a life of its own, a heartbeat. She knows she's reading too much into it, but anyway, she finds herself watching for him, learning to predict his comings and goings. She knows it's silly, she wouldn't admit it to anyone else, but she wonders if there's a secret message for her when he parks outside her house or opens his front door just as she's passing to bring in the milk. They haven't actually spoken again. At school he seems to be in the thick of things now, drawing up rotas and lists for cake sales and traffic duty. She can't get near. They laugh at his jokes, the busy bee mothers. They josh him playfully on the arm. After a while she knows it's getting out of hand. She can't stop her imaginings, even if she tries, even if she wants a rest. "I love you," she hears him tell her, "all night long. Where have you been all my life?" She spends more than she can afford on coffee-coloured lacy underwear that no one ever sees. She hardly eats or sleeps, and in the mirror her reflection shimmers. She's pretty sure she's never looked more beautiful. There's an adaptation of Madame Bovary on the TV, but Carolyn can't settle to it. She feels uneasy. Michael's late getting home from work. It's a Monday night. Mondays he's normally back by 6:30 at the latest. His house seems wrong, all dark, and with the curtains open. Carolyn wanders over to look out of her front windows, without exactly meaning to, on her way to load the washing machine, to bring her daughter a bath towel, to iron her husband's shirts. She knows that once things are back in their proper places, Michael in his house, his green VW on the road, once the red security light of his car is blinking steadily at her through the darkness, she'll feel less on edge. Then she'll be able to think straight. Her husband calls at 10 from Frankfurt. "I love you," he says, and starts to cry. "Only you," he sobs. She's standing at the window of her bedroom with the lights off, holding the cordless phone. She imagines him, her husband, in stale business clothes in his hotel room, discarded bottles of spirits from the minibar on the wood veneer unit that runs around the bed, girls gyrating on the TV with the sound turned down. "Do you think I don't know that?" she says, "after all these years." She sees Michael's car arriving, indicating, although there's no one else on the road, and reversing into a space. She cleans the window with her fingers where her breath steamed it up. "It's all going to be different," her husband tells her. "I saw myself this evening, Linny. A fat, sad old git on expenses in a third-rate hotel bar." Michael's getting out of the car, closing the driver's door, pushing in the wing mirror for the night. "It's not perfect," says Carolyn's husband. "You think I don't know that? I'm not bloody perfect." A woman's getting out of the passenger seat of Michael's car. Carolyn feels, for a second, as though her heart has stopped. She groans under her breath and steps back sharply from the window. "But it's what we have," says her husband. She can hardly hear him. He sounds so far away. "It's worth something, Linny." "It's a bad line," she says. The woman's small and dark, a neat and glossy woman in a trouser suit. Nothing like Michael. Not his sister. They're walking together up the road to Michael's house, faces turned towards each other. Carolyn can't quite see if they're touching. Michael stands aside for the woman to go through the front door first and closes it behind them. "Worth fighting for," her husband keeps on. "What we have." He's getting louder. "I won't give up, not without a fight." He's starting to sound angry. Across the road, the lights go on. Michael clambers onto the arms of the sofa like every night to close his curtains. "You don't need to fight," says Carolyn. She hasn't got the energy for this. She hasn't got the energy for anything. "Just go to sleep," she says. "You drink too much." "I'll fix that. I'll get help. I'll fix everything. You'll see. There's going to be a big change." Carolyn lies down on the bed in her clothes and pulls the duvet around her. From where she is, she can see the moon under thin cloud sitting in the angle between the chimney and the roof of Michael's house. "Maybe you could get help," she says into the phone after a while. In Michael's house, the lights go off downstairs, then on, then off upstairs. The blackness makes the moon look dazzling, makes it into a bright, shiny storybook moon against the sky. She can't stop looking at it. At first she thinks it's full, but when she looks harder, following the edge right round, comparing one side with another, she finds a tiny indentation, an almost imperceptible flattening. And after that it's obvious. The lopsidedness, the imperfection, is all she sees. "We could get help together," she says. There's no answer. She can hear her husband breathing. Shallow, regular breaths, a familiar little sigh. She can hear he's gone to sleep. "Why not?" she says, out loud to no one in the dark. "Why the hell not?" It's a fleeting thing, a truly full moon. She's not sure now that she's ever really seen one. When it comes down to it, it's one of those things that's much less common than people think.